The world needed it most. So congratulations to her. You can see the great article that they did on her on our Facebook page at VOA1 The Hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners. So we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Dr. Jill Robbins tells us ways to inspect our own writing. Brian Lin talks about a new type of meat and how Singapore has approved its sale. I will return with this week's words and their stories. I will explain the expression carrot and stick approach. Finally, we end our 30 minutes together with the making of a nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is Dr. Jill Robbins with the education report.
Recently, someone asked us, "Can you please tell me who is the highest authority or is the most respected resource regarding writing rules?" There are several excellent sources on writing rules. However, the rules are different for different fields, such as business, technology, government, or academic writing. Full-time writers often turn to a handbook, such as Strunk and White's The Elements of Style. This book, published in 1959, combined the earlier work of William Strunk Jr. and E.B. White, the writer of several popular children's books. The Elements of Style has simple rules for good writing. You can get the 1920 version of the book free on Project Gutenberg. More recent versions deal with issues of gender and changes in punctuation. Students writing a report for school may use a book like the Chicago Manual of Style from the University of Chicago. The Chicago Manual deals with English grammar and how to prepare an academic paper. It was first published in 1906. Kate L. Turabian's Manual for Writers of Research Papers, Theses, and Dissertations is based on the Chicago Manual. Her work is especially helpful for high school and college students. It is available free online. An excellent place to look for help with writing is Purdue University's Online Writing Lab, or OWL for short. As noted earlier, technical and professional writing is different from what teachers expect of writing in school. So Purdue OWL has a guide for writing business letters and technical materials. The OWL has helpful resources for writing teachers who are working remotely, too. Teachers can download presentations on many subjects related to writing. Another English learner asked us how to avoid plagiarism when writing. Plagiarism is when someone takes another person's work and passes it off as their own. Many schools publish students severely for copying the words of another writer. For those learning English, writing has different problems, and to help them, the OWL has one part especially for ESL students. It includes an explanation of how American schools deal with plagiarism. When students find information on the internet, it is too easy to copy it and put it directly into their own written work. To avoid this, the OWL urges you to take more time to deeply understand what you read. Begin by looking at books and printed materials before turning to the internet. When you find information on the internet, write down notes by hand in a notebook. As you write, put the ideas into your own words. This process is called paraphrasing. Think about the meaning of the whole work. You want to tell your reader how this information is related to your own ideas. If you use another writer's exact words, make sure to place quotation marks before and after them. And tell your reader how to find the original source. The guides I named earlier in this report explain how to quote work in different styles of writing. If you are not sure about how well you paraphrased another writer's work, there are online tools that will tell you how closely your work resembles that of someone else. Ask your school which tool they suggest. Or you can take a few lines from your written work and copy them into an internet search engine. If they are the same as another published work, the search result will probably identify that work. Another good way to test your writing is to read it aloud and see if it is easy to understand. Ask a friend or a family member to listen as you read it and tell you if they can understand. Writing well is not easy, but when finished, you will have a good feeling. You have communicated your ideas to others clearly. I'm Jill Robbins.
Next, Brian Lin brings us a food science story.
Singapore's government has approved the sale of a laboratory-grown chicken meat. The American company that invented the product, Eat Just, says it is the first time lab-grown meat has received such approval anywhere in the world. Lab-grown meat, also called clean or cultured meat, is created from animal cells in a laboratory. The product is made without harming animals. The cells grow directly into the meat outside of any animal. The Eat Just product is to be sold as small pieces, called nuggets. The product is set to launch at a Singapore restaurant in the very near term, the company's CEO, Josh Tetrick, told Reuters news agency. Singapore is an island city-state of 5.7 million people. Demand for alternatives to animal meat is rising across the world, because of public concerns about health, animal welfare, and the environment. Plant-based products, popularized by companies like Beyond Meat, Impossible Foods, and Corn, are selling in a growing number of stores and restaurants. But the development of lab-grown meat has been much slower than that of plant-based versions. The main reason for the delay is money. Lab-grown meat costs a lot more to produce. Tetrick said the San Francisco-based company is also seeking approvals from U.S. government agencies. But, he added, that Singapore was a good bit ahead of the United States. The Singapore Food Agency said it examined data from processing, manufacturing control, and safety testing before approving Eat Just sales. Tetrick said it is likely that the U.S. and countries in Europe and elsewhere will examine Singapore's approval system and will attempt to create a similar process. Eat Just said it will manufacture the product in Singapore. The company also plans to start making a plant-based egg substitute there that it is already selling in the United States. Eat Just was founded in 2011 and has raised more than $300 million, Tetrick said. The company is valued at around $1.2 billion. Worldwide, more than 24 companies are testing lab-grown fish, cow, and chicken meat. They are hoping to break into a new part of the alternative meat market. Financial experts at Barclays Bank have estimated the market could be worth up to $140 billion by 2029. Competitors in the market have also been able to raise large amounts of money and win support from well-known investors. U.S.-based Memphis Meats raised money this year in a deal led by Japan's SoftBank Group and Singapore-based Temasek. Among the Memphis Meats investors are Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and Virgin Group chief Richard Branson. In Singapore, Shiok Meats aims to become the first company to sell lab-grown shrimp. The company is backed by Harry Sosanto of the Philippines' Mondnisin Corporation, which also owns corn. I'm Brian Lynn.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. There are many ways to get people to do what you want. You can threaten them with punishment. You can also entice others with a reward. In other words, they will get something in return for some effort or service. Naturally, you can also just ask nicely. But for now, we will talk about threatening and enticing, two effective but different methods of persuasion. First, let's talk about these important words. When we persuade someone, we try to make them do something. We can entice them or offer them something very desirable. We can also make threats or promise harm. Sometimes we do both. One way of saying this is what we call the carrot and stick approach. You can say it is a method of persuasion that involves both a reward and punishment. When given a choice, most people will surely take the carrot, a popular vegetable, instead of the stick, which could hurt. For example, let's say a company has a carrot and stick approach to vacation days. They entice people to work hard by giving lots of time for paid vacations. That is the carrot. But they also threaten to take away those hours if employees refuse to work hard. That is the punishment, or stick. When we say stick, we don't mean giving a stick, we mean hitting with a stick. This kind of system may work well for some workers, but not for others. It depends on what motivates you. Do you like your work? In addition to getting paid, what satisfaction do you get from the job? Or are you only working for a paycheck? When using the carrot and stick method, it is also important to carefully consider the reward and punishment. If you do not want the carrot, you are not going to be motivated to do the work. Also, if the punishment is meaningless to you, it will not motivate you either. Many word historians say the origin of the expression carrot and stick approach is unclear. But some say it comes from the custom of urging a donkey to move forward by hanging a carrot in front of it. If it refuses to move, the caretaker might decide to hit the animal with a stick. Here is another example. The parents tried using a carrot and stick approach with their teenage daughter. They promised her a new phone if she brought up her grades, and threatened to take away her current phone if her grades dropped even lower. When it comes to learning English, a carrot and stick approach is not a good motivational tool. We here at VOA Learning English can only reward you with praise, and we promise not to punish you, nor would we want to. So I think the only thing we are giving out here is carrots. And that's Words and Their Stories for this week. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Ulysses Grant was elected President of the United States in 1868. Grant was a military hero. He led Union troops of the North to victory over Confederate troops of the South in the Civil War. Grant was extremely popular, but he was a much better general than he was a politician. As president, it was not long before he got into trouble in the battles of politics and government. Larry West and Frank Oliver talk about the first term of President Ulysses Grant.
Grant resigned from the army to run for president. However, he ran on his record as a winning general. "Let us have peace," he often said, and the people believed he would guarantee peace. In fact, Grant guaranteed nothing. As a presidential candidate, he offered no new national programs. So, as president, he had no new policies to carry out. He had few struggles with Congress, because he rarely asked Congress to do anything. Many events took place during Grant's two administrations, but he usually was not involved directly. He had problems only because he was linked indirectly to the men who were responsible.
One of President Grant's first problems was caused by two of his friends. They tried to take control of the gold market. The men were Jay Gould and James Fisk. Both were extremely rich. Gould and Fisk developed a plan to buy a large part of the nation's gold supply when the price was low. They would hold the gold until demand greatly increased the price. Then they would sell it and make a lot of money. To be successful, they had to prevent the government from selling gold on the market. Government sales of gold would keep the price down. So Gould and Fisk urged President Grant to stop the Treasury Department from selling gold. Grant refused to give them a firm promise.
The two men brought one of Grant's relatives into their plan. They paid him to write a letter to the president. It asked the president to halt government sales of gold. A messenger took the letter to the White House. He then sent a telegram to James Fisk saying the letter had been delivered. The telegram said, "Letter delivered. All right." Fisk thought this meant that President Grant had agreed to halt government sales of gold. So he began buying gold in huge amounts. Fisk was wrong. The words "all right" meant only that the letter had been delivered. They did not mean that Grant had agreed to the plan. In fact, Grant did not agree. He ordered the Treasury Department to sell gold to block the attempt by Gould and Fisk to control the gold market.
The result was that James Fisk and Jay Gould lost a great amount of money. So did other businessmen and bankers. Many Americans blamed President Grant for not acting quickly enough to stop the activity of his two friends. Concern about Grant grew after another incident was reported at the New York Customs Office. Two of Grant's friends there became involved in a plan to get money from importers. They used their official positions to earn huge amounts of money.
Grant also was criticized for one of his few independent actions as president. He tried to buy the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean. The island nation was ruled by a dictator, Buenaventura Báez. Báez was so dishonest that the people of the Dominican Republic were ready to overthrow him. Before this could happen, he offered to sell his country to the United States. When Grant received the offer, he sent a White House official to negotiate with Báez. The official returned with a treaty giving the Dominican Republic to the United States for $1.5 million. Grant immediately sent American warships to the Dominican Republic. He wanted to keep Báez in power until the treaty was completed. Grant asked the Senate to approve the treaty. Many senators opposed it. They said taking control of the Dominican Republic would cost too much money. They also said it was a bad idea for the United States to take control of any nation in the Caribbean. President Grant went to the Capitol building himself to urge senators to approve the treaty. His efforts failed. The treaty was defeated.
Grant's biggest national problem was the political situation in the former rebel states of the South. After the Civil War, most Southern states were governed by radical members of the Republican Party. Radicals supported citizenship rights and voting rights for blacks. In the late 1860s, the radicals began to lose power. Many failed to be reelected to state office. They were being defeated by candidates of the Democratic Party. Democrats did not want blacks to have any rights at all.
The first radical Republicans to lose power were those in Virginia. The change there was made peacefully. Not so in other southern states. In Tennessee, Georgia, and North Carolina, Democrats used threats and violence to win elections. Their campaigns often were led by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was a secret organization of white men. Members believed white people were greater than black people. Wearing cloths over their faces, Klansmen broke up radical Republican political meetings. They threatened, beat, and killed blacks to keep them out of politics. They did the same thing to whites who tried to organize or help blacks.
Before long, Ku Klux Klan groups were formed in every southern state. By 1871, radical Republican congressmen were demanding a new law to destroy the Ku Klux Klan. A committee headed by radicals was named to investigate Klan activities in the South. The committee heard reports of the Klan's brutal acts. It helped prepare a bill to control the Klan. After much debate, Congress passed the bill. The new law gave the president power to declare military rule in the South. Democrats charged that the real purpose of the law was to keep radical Republican state governments in power. President Grant did not wait long to use his powers under the new law. He declared military rule in a large area of South Carolina. Thousands of people there were arrested. They were tried in federal courts. Juries were made up mainly of blacks and radical whites.
This kind of justice made Southerners feel even more bitterness toward the North. It also angered a number of moderate members of the Republican Party. They said the federal government should not help radical Republicans stay in power in the South. Some of these moderate Republicans broke away from President Grant and the radicals. They called themselves liberal Republicans and formed a new political party. They held their own presidential nominating convention for the election of 1872. They nominated Horace Greeley as their candidate. Greeley published the New York Tribune newspaper.
Democrats believed their only chance to win the election was to support the new liberal Republicans. So they, too, chose Horace Greeley as their presidential candidate. As expected, the radicals who controlled the main Republican Party nominated Grant for a second term. The campaign between Grant and Greeley was very strange. Grant made no speeches. He spent the summer at a holiday town on the Atlantic Ocean coast. His supporters, however, were not silent. They called Greeley a fool and a traitor. They refused to treat him as a serious candidate. Unlike Grant, Greeley did campaign hard, but he had little financial help. He also was hurt by a poorly organized campaign.
On Election Day in 1872, Ulysses Grant won a big victory. He got the votes of 31 of the 37 states. Horace Greeley died 3 weeks after the election. The new liberal Republican Party died with him. Ulysses Grant and the radical Republicans would govern for another 4 years.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world.